Well, as you know, this is the fourth session of the week again. Courses, or rather sections 1 and 2 of 346A, The Church in the Modern Era. And we're very happy to have for the last of our series of guest lecturers, the Reverend Professor William Danker, who himself has been a missionary out in the field, Japan, surveyed in Korea, and made a trip around the world, and that's it. Welcome to the guests that we have here this morning. And all right.
Thank you, Professor Schrader. It's very nice to be with you, although it's no small task that you're setting me this morning. I'm being asked to speak about the 19th century in the world mission of the church. Kenneth Scott Lateref requires no less than 3 big volumes to cover this subject in his 7-volume set on a history of the expansion of Christianity. So, this is no light thing that we're attempting this morning, but let us endeavor and see what we can do with 3 volumes in 50 minutes. The 19th century is the great century in the world mission of the church. It can be dated in various ways. Somebody like Basil Matthews, in his History Forward Through the Ages, dates it from 1800 to 1914. Lateret himself prefers the dates 1815 to 1914. He slips it ahead 14 or 15 years so as to cover the period from the end of the Napoleonic Wars to the beginning of World War I. Now, what can we say about this era? First, it was an era of comparative peace. From the vantage point of our 20th century, we can look back with great appreciation on that. Except for the Crimean War, the Franco-Prussian War, and a few other relatively minor fusses, such as the Boer War, perhaps in China, the Daiping Revolt, and of course our own American Civil War, there was no great amount of warfare in this particular century. And therefore, it could be marked, and this is my second point, it was marked by a prodigious burst of creative energy, of wealth and power among Occidental peoples, with striking changes in their civilization and in their way of life. Invention and the application of these inventions, the application of scientific discoveries to the means of production, made it possible for people to have a much richer way of life. For example, you had in our own America such a simple thing as the cotton gin, with all of its effects for good and evil. Factories arose. The Industrial Revolution really took hold in the 19th century. And then, in addition, means of communication were stepped up considerably. There you had the application of Watt's steam engine to the steamboat and to the steam railway. And we speak of the shrinking of the world in our time, and it is indeed shrinking fast. This world of ours is just something that you can't sanforize. It just keeps on shrinking all the time. But comparatively, it shrunk even more during the 19th century. Now you could cross the ocean in a matter of weeks instead of months. Now it didn't take 6 months by sailing vessel to get out to India. Now you could do it in a matter of 4 to 6 weeks. And then, in addition, there were the improved means of communication via the telegraph, the telephone, These things all had their rise in the 19th century. Capital was piled up and accumulated. These factories produced not only goods, they produced also capital, accumulations of money, which you could then invest and make more money. And so the 19th century is the period of laissez-faire capitalism. And this capital hurled itself upon the undeveloped sections of the globe with all kinds of effects for good and for evil. Fortunes were made. There was new power, light, electricity. Then, third, because of this period of peace, because of this period of tremendous creativity, it was also, in the main, for the Western world, a time of optimism. You didn't have the nihilistic despair that has characterized much of the 20th century. The 19th century saw the popularization of the doctrine of evolution. There was a blind faith in progress. Upward, onward, excelsior. This was the watchword. If things were bad today, don't worry, they'll be better tomorrow. Man will find the answer to all of these things. He will clean up disease. He will eventually do away with war. There was much optimism about that. And so on. And so you had a poet like Swinburne singing, "Glory to man in the highest, for man is the maker of things." Fourth, the century witnessed the rapid expansion of the Occident and the domination of most of the earth by the Occident, by the West and its culture. White supremacy became the accepted attitude both of the whites and, in large part, also of the non-whites. The white man possessed the thunder stick. He possessed all of these tremendous keys of knowledge. He knew how to do things. He had medicines. He had machines. And therefore, his way of doing things, also his religion, were acceptable. They were better. And particularly England, whose population had exploded as a result of the Industrial Revolution. Incidentally, this is something that always happens, it seems to me. When a country is industrialized, its population zooms meteorically. And therefore, just an aside into the 20th century, what's going to happen when China's 600 million are industrialized? And what if, as one speaker at the Natural Resources Conference here in St. Louis declared not long ago, what if, just as Africa, for example, is moving directly from the period of bush paths to airplanes, jumping over the intermediate stage of the railway almost entirely. What if China should, in its industrialization program, jump over the manually operated factory, jump over that stage completely directly into automation? This may not happen, it probably won't happen, but what if it could? Next. During this period of the expansion of the Occident and the domination of the earth by its culture, you have the European nations carving up the world like a Thanksgiving turkey. David Livingstone had this burning desire to bring the gospel to Africa. He wanted to clean up the slave trade. He wanted to open Africa both to commerce and Christianity as a way of putting an end to the slave trade and making it possible for the missionaries to follow him. But what was the actual result? Not long after David Livingstone's death, a conference was held in 1885, and the various European nations just cut Africa in pieces like a pie. One nation said, I'll take this, and the other one said, I'll take that. The only thing that David Livingstone was accomplished at all, that David Livingstone accomplished was this, that all of them together, in their grabbing, agreed, we shall not countenance the slave trade. But Africa became a series of colonies of Western nations. It became the victim of their imperialistic ambitions. And the fifth point is this, that expansion brought about the beginnings of revolution in the cultures of most of the rest of mankind. Under the impact of this Western expansionism, these cultures could not hold themselves. They changed. Particularly primitive cultures were unable to stand. Also in age-old China and in India, there were profound changes. Think of a country like Japan, for example. Japan, for 250 years, had kept itself isolated behind an iron curtain that makes the present iron curtain of Soviet Russia look as though it were made of cheesecloth. When they lowered the boom, they lowered it. Early in the 17th century, they made it a capital offense for anyone to leave the country or anyone to enter the country. And remember, there were thousands of Japanese. This is about the time when the Pilgrim Fathers landed on Plymouth Rock. There were thousands of Japanese then in the seaport cities of China as traders, merchants, and so on. On pain of death, they were forbidden to return to their native land. They wanted no traffic in and they wanted no traffic out. And in this way, Japan endeavored to accomplish two objectives. One, it sought to save itself from the fate of much of the rest of Asia. It sought to save itself from the fate of becoming a colony of a Western power. It had missionaries. A very fine beginning had been made. Francis Xavier, who had been there for only 2 years, 1549 to 1551, had set something in motion that netted 300,000 converts by the year 1600. But a Portuguese sailor said something very untactful one day when he was brought up before a Japanese official for some of his offenses. He threatened that if they did not let him go, his king would punish them. And he said, see, he pointed to the missionaries, these are but the advance agents. First the missionaries and then come the soldiers. In addition, the various Catholic orders, the Jesuits and the Franciscans, were engaged in inter-order rivalry. There's as much divisiveness inside the Roman Church as there is within Protestantism, incidentally. They were engaged in inter-order rivalry. One of them backed this section, another one backed that faction within the nation. That were involved in various political entanglements, and the result was that the whole group got thrown out. Another factor was that the Tokugawa family adopted this means of exclusion of all foreigners as the best way to preserve its own particular dynasty. However, Japan is an example of a country that sought for many years to hold itself against this colonial expansionism of Western nations. And finally, our own Commodore Perry from America brought his black ships into Uraga Bay, south of Yokohama, and at gunpoint forced Japan to open up. Sam did that under duress. But having opened up, it quickly realized that the only way it could possibly maintain its national existence was to industrialize, to westernize, and to do it fast. And so Japan, in 80 years, covered the whole distance that Europe and the nations of the West had covered in 400 years. And this nation that was still in feudalism, as late as 1868, the period of the time of the Meiji Restoration, in World War II, built the biggest battle wagons that the world, that the oceans of the world have ever floated. You had two 70,000-ton ships, the Yamato and her sister ship. Remember the mighty Mo, the Missouri, named after this state, on whose decks the surrender was signed, was only a ship of 45,000 tons. It mounted 18-inch rifles. The Yamato had 20-inch rifles, the biggest that were ever made. Japan did that in this astonishingly brief period of time. And tremendous changes took place within her society as a result of this. And that's just an example of what happened elsewhere in the world. By the way, Japan has never been anybody's colony. And in that way, it is unique in Asia and Africa, for that matter. Now, this expansionism and also the good results that this expansionism accomplished, namely doing away with the slave trade, prison reform, doing away with cannibalism, with many of the superstitious and evil practices of people around the world, doing away with sati in India, the custom of widows flinging themselves upon the funeral pyres of their husbands. All of this can be traced back to that ingredient within Western culture which is known as Christianity. And Christianity has therefore accomplished a great deal. At the same time, we must ask the question, how much of the creation of slums, which was a byproduct of the Industrial Revolution, the exploitation of the worker which occurred, and war, which was a byproduct of capitalistic expansionism, how much of this must also be laid at the door of Christianity? This is something that deserves further study. In Christendom itself in the 19th century, there was a seeming paradox. On the one hand, you saw the most and the largest defections from Christianity since the days of Islam. Christianity never lost so heavily since the time of Muhammad in the 7th century as it did during the 19th century. And on the other hand, you also had the greatest awakening that Christianity ever saw. You had the greatest gains that Christianity ever made through its world mission program. The church was attacked bitterly in the 19th century. Rationalism continued. Atheism reared its head. It was Nietzsche in Europe, and it was Ingersoll in America, and both of them were the sons of Protestant ministers. Agnostics followed in the train of Herbert Spencer. Marx attacked the church as a bulwark of the exploiting classes. Immigrants who traveled to the United States by the millions were in danger of lapsing into paganism. In the 18th century, Francis Asbury had been sent to America by Charles Wesley, and he found that only one out of 14 of the colonists still had any relation with a Christian church. America was in tremendous danger of lapsing into paganism. While Roman Catholicism in the Counter-Reformation spread all over the world, in the Americas, in Asia, Francis Xavier coming way out to Japan as the first white man to enter it, only 3 years after Martin Luther's death. Protestantism was terribly slow in getting started. It, of course, suffered from the religious wars. It had a great deal of doctrinal controversy within its own midst. It had much to do in setting its own house in order. But at the start of the 19th century, Protestantism had virtually no missions, and Roman Catholicism had had a full 150 years head start in world missions. And may I say that Cardinal Bellarmine used this as one of his arguments in maintaining that Protestantism could not be the true church because it had no missions. And we cannot say that his argument is wholly without weight, even though he misapplied it. Protestantism had no missions, virtually none. If you subtract the Moravians and Constantinsdorf, you don't have much left. There were less than 1 million Protestants in the whole world outside of Europe at the start of the 19th century. There were three great reasons for modern missions. One of them was the Moravian influence, Count Zinzendorf, channeled through the Wesleys. And second was the evangelical awakening that occurred in the church, particularly as the result of the work of John Wesley. And then the great awakening which took place in America, and ultimately leading to the second great awakening right at the end of the 18th century. In America, in the colonies, Jonathan Edwards had been a part of this Preparatio Evangelica too. Now, this evangelical awakening emphasized individual conversion, personal commitment in faith. It stressed the cultivation of the life of the Spirit through Bible study, prayer, public worship, and preaching. Remember this individualistic cast of religion that came out of this evangelical awakening. It has its effect for good and for bad through the world mission that we shall trace. There was indeed a social passion that also came out of this period. It gave rise to a great many social reforms. The abolition of slavery, which took place as a result of the work of William Pitt, his fiery speeches, and the campaign of Wilberforce, which outlawed slavery in the British Empire early in the 19th century. Elizabeth Fry with her prison reforms, and so on. All of this comes out of the evangelical awakening. But strangely, the evangelical awakening, which emphasizes an individual piety and inwardness, while it does not say too much about our living together as Christians in this particular world, also in a way left the world, left this scheme of things to the secularists, to the materialists. And so you had people who were very devout Christians in an inward way, still participating in great social evil. You had a man like Sir John Bowring who could write the hymn, "In the cross of Christ I glory," at Macau. I saw that cross which inspired that great hymn. And yet the same man could sail in a gunboat up the Yangtze and take part in the Opium War against China, which forced the opium traffic on China itself, and which made of China a very reluctant vassal of Western imperialism. So there are these contradictions. Yet, much mission work took place. During this period, through the evangelical awakening, the pattern of the church changes from established churches that are found within a given nation to voluntary societies. Use the term that James Hastings Nichols prefers. People who had passed through the same experience of the Great Awakening found one another across denominational lines, and mission societies were formed of people from among various denominations. 1792, William Carey, the Baptist Mission Society. 1795, The London Missionary Society, which was interdenominational, congregational, Anglican, Presbyterian. Today, it's largely congregational. In 1799, the Church Missionary Society, the CMS. For years, it had to send Lutherans to India because no Anglican priests, Lutherans from Germany, because no Anglican priests were willing to go. In 1804, the British and Foreign Bible Society was formed, and not long thereafter, the American Bible Society. In 1806, in America, you had an event that was very important in the mission movement here. That was the famous Haystack Prayer Meeting. A group of students from Williams College found themselves taking refuge in a haystack during a thunderstorm. And there, these students of evangelical persuasion carried on a prayer meeting. And in that prayer meeting, they vowed to one another to devote themselves to take the gospel to the far corners of the earth. And this prayer meeting was of decisive importance in starting the foreign missionary movement in America. Now, permit me to analyze with you some of the strengths and weaknesses of 19th century mission. It was a century of great strengths and great weaknesses. It was a great century. We have already spoken of the individualism that characterized the people coming out of the evangelical awakening. This evangelical awakening produced flaming, dedicated witnesses. It produced an age of giants. And yet, they were not without their feet of clay. Take, for example, a man like Adoniram Judson. He went out to Burma as a result of that haystack prayer meeting and the resultant forming of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. It took him 6 months to get out to India in those days when you had wooden ships and iron men. And on the way out to India, he had a lot of time to read his Bible, and whereas he'd started as a good New England Puritan, congregational, ends up out in India when his boat finally docks there as a Baptist. Now, all good Baptists will say this is because he read his Bible so faithfully and discovered that, of course, immersion is the only scriptural form of baptism. This is very fine grist for any Baptist mill, but the real story, I'm persuaded, although this is the story that you'll read in nearly all the books, the only one I've ever found. But I found a little microfilm in Swift Library in Chicago University one day, and it just looks a little different. This is what I found. The American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions, which was the first mission board which was formed to send Judson out, you had the first mission board and the first missionary. You also had the first misunderstanding between mission board and missionary, and that continues to the present day, too. But in this case, I think the missionary was a little more wrong than the mission board. Although my sympathy generally always lies with the missionary. But in this case, the mission board was more right than he was. They had never been in the foreign mission business before, but as good New England Puritans, they laid down this as one of their rubrics. The missionary, when he gets out there, shall baptize such Hindus as shall come to faith in Jesus Christ together with their children and servants. This is kind of the Old Testament covenant idea, you know, which was taken over by the Puritans. But that bothered Judson. He wanted believer's baptism. You had to pass through this particular individual experience. You had to pretty near be able to say at what moment, what time on the clock it was, on what day of the calendar when you were converted. And then you could be baptized. this came out of the evangelical awakening, you see. Ignoring completely the kind of thing that, for instance, happened when St. Paul baptized the jailer at Philippi. We read that that night he baptized not only the jailer, but his whole household, didn't he? And the other members of the household had not passed through just exactly the same kind of crisis experience that the jailer had. But St. Paul or Silas baptized the whole group. And so you had immediately a whole family church. Now, Asia is a society that is organized not around the individual, as was our own, but around the family, the clan, the group. An individual makes very few decisions for himself. Even in Japan to this day, a young man wants to get married. The family has a council and talks it over, and they find the wife for him, too. Saves him a lot of time and trouble and expense. They decide to which school he will go. They decide whether he'll go to England or to America to study. This is all talked over. And in America, you had, on the other hand, a very individualistic society. Rugged individualism. A man plunges out into the frontier and with his own strong right arm, he carves out a kingdom for himself. This is a day of personal individual initiative. And this is reflected, of course, in the way the West approached religion. Thus, you've had this, in a way, I think, unfortunate result, that in Asia, you had an emphasis through foreign missions on baptizing people out of their society. You take one member of a family here, another member of a family there, and there wasn't the kind of concern with families which I think you find in the New Testament. There wasn't enough concern with getting natural social grouping. And so the lone Christian who was baptized out of a family frequently came to be an outcast. And this has, in the long run, slowed the advance of Christianity in Asia, in my opinion. And it is only today that missionary thinkers are becoming aware of the importance of winning whole social groupings. And thus you have a man like Donald McGavran, author of 1956 volume, The Bridges of God, advocating now an approach that would seek to win natural social groups, families, clans, communities. And Kenneth Cragg, in his book, The Call of the Minaret, is saying that this is the only way we can attack Islam. You can't baptize an individual out of Mohammedanism. And it is a matter of plain record that the only successful attack on Islam has been a community approach. Did you know that on the island of Java, for instance, you have a community of 80,000 to 100,000 Christians who once were Muslim? Next, we take up intramural. This may be fantastic, but it was done, you see. It may sound fantastic to you when you've been hearing all your life about painfully winning one or two or three after 50 years of work. But you see, it illustrates this principle of the necessity of a community approach. Another weakness. So the individualism was a strength. The individualism was a strength because it emphasized real, deep, inner conviction. But it was a weakness, too, as I've outlined. Another thing that was, in my opinion, both a strength and a weakness was the principle of white tutelage. White tutelage. The white man coming in as the keeper of all kinds of mysteries, and then he imparts these. Education, sanitation, whatnot. He provides social uplift. He teaches. On the other hand, this white tutelage brought with it also the weakness of paternalism in missions. The grandfatherliness, or the kind of thing that makes the missionary act like the great white father. He's the dispenser of knowledge. He's the dispenser of counsel. He's the dispenser of money. He pays the salaries of the national pastors and so on. Did you know that the whole emphasis on the indigenous church had its rise, of course, in the mission field? It was particularly among the Karens in Burma that it first succeeded. The Karens, under the missionaries' wise leadership in that case, were paying their own pastors, they were building their own churches, and all this 100 years ago. The missionaries had a terrible time about the whole thing. With whom do you think? The mission boards. The mission boards here at home thought it was terrible. The Baptist mission board here in America thought it was dreadful that they were asking those poor, poor people in Burma to build their own chapels out of their poverty and support their own pastors. Why? Hadn't they heard the missionaries? Hadn't they heard that the gospel is supposed to be free? It was actually used as an argument. And for decades, there was a running controversy between the missionaries in the field and the mission board about the scripturalness of this indigenous approach, which is, of course, a commonplace today. There was, under white tutelage, also a fatuous reliance on education and schools as a device for winning people to Christ. I believe that experience shows that mission schools in the Orient have immunized millions against Christianity. You've had people like Gandhi, Radhakrishnan, and others. They're products of mission schools. It has only served to immunize them against Christianity and bring their own paganism to a higher level and a more sophisticated expression. You may be shocked to know that there are mission schools in Asia that have a very tiny minority of Christians. When I visited a mission school down on the island of Kyushu, out of 1,200 young men enrolled in this high school, there were 50 baptized Christians. Out of 800 girls enrolled in a girls' high school, a somewhat higher percentage, 200 were Christians. But you see, what happens in that situation is that the Christians are a persecuted minority in their own school. And Bishop Manikam was quite right the other day when he said that there were too many Christian colleges in India, 49 of them. Not only too many of them, there are too many non-Christian students in those Christian colleges. And this was a profound mistake, which the missionaries of the 19th century made, as it seems to me. Take, for instance, in India today. Which is the state that has gone communist? The state that has the highest percentage of graduates of colleges, and also including Christian colleges. It's the state of Kerala, and one-third, 33% of the people in Kerala are Christians. Colonialism was both a great strength and a great weakness of 19th century missions. Colonialism, the power of Western governments and armies, opened the country, made it safe for missionaries to live and preach and work. But it also exploited the people. It suppressed them. It may have put a stop to cannibalism, but it did not put a stop to greedy white capitalists exploiting these people. And earlier than that, in the period of slavery, before that was ended, you had a great many white slavers, blackbirders, and so forth, who were kidnapping these people and selling them into slavery. Colonialism made the world safe for the missionary, but it also identified the missionary with imperialism. And he's paying the price for that in our century. This is why the missionary is finding the going tough in India today. It is true the missionary, did more than anybody else to temper, to modify the grinding exploitation of the people by Western colonialistic interests. This must be said. Another thing that was both a strength and a weakness of 19th century missions was denominational divisiveness. Denominational divisiveness put many missions into the field. It is always risky for any mortal to try to guess at the purposes of God, but it seems to me that one of the reasons why God permitted the Reformation to lead to the unfortunate result of many divided denominations is this: that a united church had never done very much about the world mission. When the church was one, Genghis Khan appealed for 100 priests to teach the Christian gospel to the peoples of Asia. The whole mighty Christian church, all united as it was then, sent exactly 2 people out to Genghis Khan. That's all it could come up with. A united church will say, all right, we've sent 2, we've done our job. A divided church sent 2. It sent 20 on behalf of every denomination, see? The Baptists would send somebody out. All right, the Presbyterians had to get into the act. They provoked one another to good works, and finally even the Lutherans got into it, although rather late. I'm speaking now of the Lutherans from over here in America. The Lutherans from Europe were the first to get in. In the case of Siegenbalch and Blitzschau, 1706, the Danish Halle mission, they were the first to get in. And all the textbooks you read, even to this day, will say that William Carey, the pioneer, first Protestant missionary, with him the age begins. This is nonsense, of course, as Bishop Moneycomb adequately pointed out the other day. But it's the fault of us Lutherans for not having told the story to the world. As I was reminded by others when we were discussing it at Chicago. Now, denominational divisiveness multiplied the number of missionaries in the field, and I think this has to be admitted. This may be one of the ways in which God uses the errors of man in order to accomplish good purposes. But this divisiveness also kept them from making their maximum impact. And this was true particularly in such a critical area as theological education. What happens is that everybody gets a little seminary with 10 or 15 students, with 1 or 2 professors, and with 3 or 4 books. See? And in theological education particularly, putting confessional interests aside for the moment, not because they're unimportant, but just looking at the thing pragmatically. In theological education particularly, a much better job could have been done, and a much better trained ministry could have been produced if they had pulled their efforts. But, and this is significant in the purposes of God, from the mission field there also came the impulse for unity, which is characterizing the church of our time. God divided the church. Let me just put it in this inaccurate way for the moment. God may have divided the church in order to send it out into all the world. And then, having sent it out into all the world, he may be there on the mission field, bringing it back together again and ultimately healing the divisions which are found also here at home. It is a fact that the modern ecumenical movement has had its rise on the mission field. It brought together also the supporters of missions here at home. The first Union Mission Conference was held in 1854 here in America, and it was held because of the visit of the great Scottish missionary to India, Alexander Duff, who became the first professor of missions, incidentally, in the Protestant world at the New College, Edinburgh. Committee arrangements were entered into on the mission field very early. The lands were so vast, the number of all the missionaries was so few, that they soon saw that it was folly to reduplicate one another's efforts, and so geographical areas were assigned by common agreement to various bodies, and this committee becomes the foundation of all later cooperation. And finally, in Edinburgh, 1910, you have the first great international missionary conference. And this is, of course, an important milestone in the development of the modern ecumenical movement, which is the child of the modern world mission. Yes, sir. It's a good place to stop.
I'm sure that some of the gentlemen would like to direct some questions to you. It's been very fine. I didn't expect it was going to be like this. It was entirely a different type of lecture. I'm very happy. There's so many things that I didn't think I would learn. So, if anyone has a question.
Yes, sir.
How far did the Lutherans go in terms of coming together with other bodies?
The Lutheran Church?
Yes.
Well, it matters very much which Lutheran Church. If you're referring to our own, of course, the answer is that we have always taken the stand that we could not compromise our doctrinal, our confessional position. And therefore, we have historically generally stood aside from these union movements. However, I think we've had our influence upon them, and I think where we have been at our best, I think we have witnessed to these movements and have had our impact upon them.
Do you think that was
It's my opinion that our witness to our scriptural and confessional stand is our distinct contribution to the world mission. Our distinct and unique contribution to the world mission, and I think we should continue to give it. I believe in the past there have been times when we have failed to give the witness. We have been We have frequently even refused to meet these people, even in such a thing as a free conference, historically, now I'm speaking. In certain instances, we've failed to meet them. But I think in India today, we are talking to them, we are witnessing, and that witness is having its impact. There were cases, other missionaries will tell you this, it's a story that will unfortunately probably never die. One of our missionaries in India was invited to the home of a fine Christian of another denomination. And he was invited for a good evening meal. And having put away this good meal, the host then began to get out his Bible and to conduct the evening devotion, as was his custom, at the table with his family. The missionary here, in this case, what shall we call this? A very vigorously protesting fellowship, actually excused himself and his family and went out onto the veranda until they were finished with their prayer and their devotion. So, at times in the past, we've done that. And we have absented ourselves from any opportunity of making a witness. But we're not doing that today in India. This just doesn't characterize us anymore. That would caricature us. And we are making our witness. We're making our witness in other parts of the world. And I think this is our unique contribution, and I think we should make it. But I'm sure all of us are persuaded first that per se, and this is the pragmatic standpoint from which I've been talking, that a divided church is not according to the will of God, and second, that a united church, if it be united on Christ and his true word, is according to the will of God.